What's up, guys? Episode number 74 of the Hellebass Bass Fishing Podcast. This week, we sit down with Minnesota slash Wisconsin's own Bob Downey, Bassmaster Elite Series Pro, talking about the big jump from his rookie season to his sophomore season and what he's looking forward to going to Northern Swing trying to make next year's 2022 Bassmaster Classic at Lake Hartwell. Some good nuggets on Mega Live Imaging as well. Listen to the whole show. I'm sure you're going to learn something. As always, we're here to help you guys catch more big bass and suck less.
This week, the Hellebass Bass Fishing Podcast is brought to you by Arsenal Fishing. Arsenal Fishing offers premium custom-made performance apparel and tackle. Arsenal delivers a wide variety of custom-designed baits, accessories, and tools, along with unique utilitarian apparel for all outdoor enthusiasts. As part of their support, you can use code HELLEBASS15 to save 15% on all purchases at arsenalfishing.com to support the show. Now let's get back to helping you catch more bass and suck less.
It's good.
All right, welcome to another Wednesday night Hellebass Live. Tonight we got Bassmaster Elite Series Rapala Pro sophomore season Bob Downey. What's up, Bob? How are you doing tonight?
I'm good, doing good, Rich. Thanks for having me on. I think is right about this time of year last year. I think July-ish that I was on with you, so it's good to be back. And I think you're good luck last year. I had like my two best finishes of the year after we talked. So hopefully that'll be the case this year.
Well, there you go. That's what we need. I mean, that's what you need right now. We'll talk more about that a little bit later for sure. Hey, everybody in the chat, let us know, how does Bob sound? How's the video? How we both sound? So we don't get too far in. Let's make sure everything sounds and looks good. What's up, Bo? Chad Eddings in the house. What's going on, buddy? So, David says we look and sound good on Facebook. So I assume YouTube is just as good.
Cool.
Yeah. So you're officially the first time, or the first second Bassmaster, or repeat Bassmaster Elite Series guests.
Oh, nice. What an honor.
There you go. Yeah. Last year, I think it was like early August, but it was like after the fourth tournament last year. Mm-hmm. So. It was last year was a really weird season.
Yeah.
What's up, John Wood?
Hey, good John. Job. Thanks, John.
And we were talking about a lot about last year about like, hey, what's it like to be a rookie? And, are the guys super accepting? And we kind of talked through all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think tonight we'll talk a little bit more about like how this season's gone. What did you learn? Last year you had some really good finishes down the stretch. And, what's the biggest adjustment or the biggest learnings or, you know, what has helped about going into year two and things like that. And then kind of talk about how the season's going to finish.
Yeah.
So I guess what's the biggest thing you think, like going into year two, kind of you went to handling school in your first year. What was the biggest thing do you think that like having a year under your belt going into year two?
Just getting more comfortable, you know, competing against those guys. I mean, even though I've been fishing tournaments since I've been 14 years old, you know, it's not like fishing tournaments is new to me, but when you get to that level, you can't really hide so much. Like you're in the public eye way more than any other tournament that you've ever been in. And, you know, the first couple of events that I could definitely feel that pressure. And now that you do it more and more, just like anything in life, you know, when you do things more and more, you just get more comfortable with the process. And you have, you know, having some good finishes gives you some confidence too, for sure. But then when you bomb some tournaments, you wonder, you know, can I hang with these guys, or what am I doing with my life? Or is this a bad decision? You know, all those things run through your head too. But really just get more comfortable with it. Like just the travel aspect. I traveled a decent amount in college and in the opens and stuff too, but you just learn, you know, more things to just make your time on the road a little bit easier and more enjoyable. And the other thing I kind of went into this year just with try to have more of a I wouldn't say a laid back attitude, but just like an attitude of really kind of enjoying the process and the ride a little bit more than last year and not getting so wigged out about everything. And because they're going to make major cuts after this year because they didn't cut anybody last year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I still could bomb these last two and not even be around next year. I hope I don't. I would love to be able to continue to do this, but I didn't want to just like go through the year and be stressed out about it. And then all of a sudden it'd be done and I maybe didn't requalify. And then you kind of just let your dream just pass you by sort of thing without really enjoying it as much. So I've tried to just kind of be a little more laid back with it this year. And at times it's been good. You know, it's definitely like going into Neely Henry after Lake Fork, Lake Fork was my worst finish I've ever had on the elites. And I was, you know, pretty much like a no care attitude going into Neely. And then you have, you know, a top 10 finish. So it's kind of weird how that works in tournament fishing sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. Like, obviously I've not fished the Elite Series, but like you, I've been fishing tournaments for a long time. And like, you get on a little bit of a heater and you feel like every decision is the best decision in the world. You know, you can just pick up a spinnerbait or a chatterbait or a jig and flip it in there and you feel like you're going to catch one. And then you're like one bad day of practice away from thinking you're never going to catch a bass again.
It's really weird how that happens. And even like you try and be mentally strong through those times, but it's just amazing how you have a bad event and you just think, you know, you never want to fish a tournament again, but then you have a good one and you're kind of on, you know, riding that wave again. So it's just such a roller coaster ride, as you know, how that can be with tournament fishing.
Yeah. Actually, I've been like, I've actually cashed a few checks this year and like, but I've missed winning a couple tournaments by now, like 2/10, 3/10, 3 ounces. And like, it's, it starts to grind on me. Like, I'm thinking like, am I just like a guy that doesn't win? Am I allergic to winning? Like, am I just like a check casher? Do I not win? Like, it's just like, it doesn't even matter. Even when you're doing well, if you don't do even better, then you even start to think like, man, am I just a top 40 guy? Do I never, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's just maybe how tournament fishermen are wired. At least the ones that are real driven, like, even if you win a tournament, you might still think about the fish you lost during that day.
I didn't get big bass today.
Yeah, right. So it's not a bad thing to kind of feel that way, as long as we don't beat ourselves up too much about it. Because I think you kind of need that edge to drive yourself to get better. But I don't know. There's a fine line there between beating yourself up too much and kind of making sure you keep that drive.
Yeah. It's a good point, Bo. Sometimes you just got to be like Steph Curry and just keep throwing them up. Just keep taking those shots.
Yeah.
What's up, Tim? Sycamore DJ. Thanks, everybody, joining in. What was I going to say? I had a thought. Oh, before we forget, thanks to Arsenal Fishing for supporting the stream, supporting the channel. Awesome dudes, Dan Fabiano, and he actually was in my recent video. He fished this last tournament with me. So make sure you guys check them out. Support them, support the channel. I'll put the code up at the bottom, Hellabass15. Get yourself some sun shirts, hats, swagger, some tactical minnows, lots of good stuff. So don't forget about them. Enough of that. Doug wants to know, what's the number one thing you learned since joining the elites?
Man, I mean, there's so many things, but you really – like I followed the sport about as close as anybody follows the sport for, you know, since my high school years. And you really don't get a real good feel for how good these guys are until you actually compete against them like week to week. I definitely like knew they were good and respected the fact that they were good, but it's really amazing how no matter what's going on, they figure it out and they don't even, a lot of times they don't just figure it out. They like smash them. I mean, like on Eufaula last year when the cut was 17 pounds after day one. And I thought, you know, the cut would be 13, 14 pounds. And it's just, so that's been pretty eye opening. You know, there's so many different things. I mean, I've learned more and like grown as an angler more in the last 2 years than I probably have in the last 10, just because they push you to be that much better. and just really like really dial in your tackle and really be, you know, as honed into your craft as you possibly can. Because if you're not, you're just going to get left in the dust.
Yeah, for sure. Man, like, I am not good at keeping a train of thought tonight.
It's all good.
Yeah, it's like drinking from a fire hose on the Elite Series, right? Like, I mean, you go fun fish and you fish local tournaments, you're still learning all the time, but like, you're just jumping in the deep end, right? And it's like, you either just get, you know, rolled in the current and swept away and by the, you know, the tide, or you figure it out and you get better, right?
Yeah. And that's what's, for me, I really enjoy that part. Like, that tells me, even after a bad tournament, if I'm still like hungry to continue to learn and get better, that tells me like, this is what I want to be doing still. It's not like I really want, I might think that I want to be done with tournament fishing like the day after a bad tournament, but then a couple of days go by and I'm like right back at it and hungry to learn and get better at what I'm doing. And so that's what is kind of cool about the Elite Series, is you just, you know, they push you to be better. And if you have a passion for it and a drive for it, it's, you know, that part's fun, actually.
Yeah. Chad wants you to expand on the dialing in your tackle. What does that mean? Like, what
yeah, kind of stuff? So, well, for an example, and a lot of people might think I'm nuts, but before I qualified for the Elites, I didn't own a Megabass jerkbait or a Jackhammer chatterbait. Or like, I just didn't. I didn't throw them up here. Like, I threw them some, like jerkbaits and like the knockoff brand chatterbaits. And I didn't spend the money on like higher end tackle because I just didn't think I needed to. And up here, you can kind of get away with, you know, our largemouth fishing in our natural lakes. You know, you're not, some of that stuff you don't necessarily need, but you start traveling the country and you, and when I like started using that tackle and started seeing the results, it's like, holy crap, I really need to be like paying attention to like that cutting edge or like the higher end stuff, because it legitimately, like it does work. And it comes down to split rings, treble hooks, like, you know, higher end hard baits. It really, what you guys see on tour, what guys are using, is that stuff, it does really work. Like, it's so, like, treble hooks is a big thing that I would change them out occasionally, but I'm like religious with it now, where it's, you know, I'm changing them out, it, you know, a couple times a day when I'm cranking or throwing a jerk bait or top water, that sort of thing. And I used to never do that back home in tournaments. You know, I'd maybe swap them out, you know, before the season started and not really pay attention. Yeah, right. So that kind of stuff. Like last year on St. Clair, I was cracking a tube every day. And, you know, every day I would swap out my jig head and my tube jig for a fresh hook, even though it probably didn't really need it. But it just kind of gives you the confidence that you're using, you know, tackle that is, you know, 100% like in good working condition. It's just like controlling all the variables, right? It's like paying attention to all those little details can definitely help. And especially at that level where everybody's so good and it's such a fine line between like making the cut or missing it by a couple pounds, you know, sometimes that, you know, changing out for a fresh treble might help you. Like last year on the St. Lawrence, I landed a 5-pound smallie on a spy bait and it literally had one treble hook like right in its snout, and I fought it for what felt like 10 minutes, but I ended up landing it. And I don't know if you'd land that fish on just a stock treble that's, you know, maybe not as sticky sharp as some of them that are out there.
Yeah. And sometimes it's even just like, not even necessarily like more expensive stuff or but sometimes it's even just like the right tool, right? Because like this past weekend, I was practicing and I was throwing a different chatterbait in the spring, the weird weed and grass on Big Stone that I was fishing. The chatterbait or the bladed jig I was throwing just wouldn't snap free. Mm-hmm. And just made a slight adjustment to a slightly different style. And then I could rip it free and I could cover the water and I could be more efficient. So it wasn't even like necessarily a more expensive chatterbait or even, but it was just a slightly different one. And that one ripped through the grass better. Now, if I would have been fishing wood or rocks or just, it probably wouldn't have mattered. But for that, it took a specific bladed jig style to catch them.
100%. Yeah, that's a really good point. Like rods and the type of line you're using and like making sure your setup is right for what you're fishing and the cover you're fishing. Around here, I had the same setups for years, but when I started traveling around the country and you're fishing different places and different, styles of grass that we don't really have around here, you kind of got to switch some of that up and make sure that you are using the right rod and the right line and the right bait for the job. And I bounce a lot of ideas off. I've got to know Pat Schlapper pretty well this year. And if anybody, Pat, he's just an absolute stud in this area. And I've learned a lot from him too, just on like the right setups. Not that I didn't know what to do, but just to like kind of confirm or like swim jigs is a good example. Like it seems like people have different setups, quite a bit different setups for swim jigs, depending on like open water or in grass or deep or shallow. And so it's kind of nice to have someone to bounce ideas off of for that sort of stuff and just kind of compare notes anyways.
Yeah, absolutely. You grow up in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and you could probably just have like 6-7 foot medium heavies and fish everything on them.
And that's what I had. Yeah. Like that's seriously what I had. And a few big, longer rods for punching grass or like throwing frogs over mats. But, I didn't crank. I cranked some shallow, but I didn't crank deep much outside of some rock every so often in the summer. So just all that, you're learning kind of on the fly, like throwing a shad wrap in 42 degree water on the Tennessee River and Fort Loudoun. I'd never done that before.
Right.
So
you never did that on pool two?
Not, I haven't actually. Have you caught him doing that?
Smalling? Yeah, I've done some flat sides and things and on the river.
Yeah. I did one day, I remember a while back, but that was it.
I'm not saying I've done it a ton, but like just, every now and then you get ice out and the water's not flooded and, it's just like.
Yeah.
So for the people that don't know you, Bob, where are you from?
Yeah, so I grew up in Eagan, Minnesota. So just south of St. Paul, Minneapolis, Twin Cities area of Minnesota. And now I live in Hudson, Wisconsin, which is only a half hour out of the Twin Cities. And grew up fishing around Metro Lakes and northern Minnesota. And then after my college years, I really fished the Mississippi River quite a bit. So like for the last 10, 11 years, I've fished the river probably more than I fished the Metro Lakes, actually.
Yeah, it's addicting. Like I started fishing a few BFLs down there, and it was just a lot of fun to go down there. I just wish I had more time to carve out. I'd love to fish the BFLs more.
Yeah, it's made me a better angler, to be honest. Like it's just a totally different deal than fishing natural lakes. So I'm actually glad I've spent a lot of time down there. Unbeknownst to me at the time, it's definitely helped me at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah. Fishing the little natural lakes around the Twin Cities and fishing jig worms and stuff it's good to know, but like that doesn't translate to Gunnersville and Sandy Cooper and Lake Fork and things like that.
No, maybe Champlain a little bit, but that's about it.
So for you guys that like, if you want to learn more about Bob's backstory, we went much more in depth last time. So like if you enjoy Bob tonight, you think he's cool, you want to learn more about him, I encourage you, I'll put a link in the description or you can just search Bob on my channel or on Facebook and you can get a much deeper dive. We covered a lot of that last time I was on. Dan's checking in. What's up, Dan?
How you going? I haven't seen Dan in years.
Yeah, I don't know. Does he even fish anymore, Dan?
I think he fishes some. I don't know if he fishes tournaments, but I think he still fishes some.
Yeah, you can hit stuff anywhere.
Yeah.
Chad wants to know, what's your favorite pool?
Man, I'd have to say, man, it's hard to choose. I like 4, 5A, and then the lacrosse pool. But the one I probably spent the most time on is pool 4 out of Wabasha. Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm going to just go for fun, I'll go down to pool 4. And I actually fished around Red Wing a little bit last year during kind of our months off. And actually had a lot of fun around Red Wing, too. Some good fishing around there that I don't think gets touched a lot.
Yeah, I think you can catch some good fish, but I don't think it would hold up to, like, tournament pressure.
If right.
It's getting beat on.
Yeah, if you're, like, going out of Wabasha, Ian, you could run up there and be, like, one of only a few boats. You might do well, but I don't think it would do well with a number of boats up there.
No. I think 5A is my favorite.
Yeah, 5A is cool. There's just so much good backwater there. It's fun.
I don't know. You should probably ask Iron Man and ask him what he thinks. What Iron Man thinks of being the second most famous, right?
What it's like is you get asked everywhere you go if you're a junior or not. So that's what it's like. Like, pretty much every time I show my ID at the airport or pay for something with an ATM or a credit card, you kind of get the question. So it's fine, though.
Because, like, I guess on your – are you Robert? On your
I am. But one of my my now fiance, her little nephew, he's into kind of the superheroes, so I get to play Iron Man every so often, so that's kind of cool.
It's not a bad deal. Have you ever dressed up as Iron Man for Halloween? Hard hitting.
No, but I did for his birthday.
There you go.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. All right, so let's talk about the year in hand. So you're 50th in points right now, I think, right?
Yeah, right around there.
As of now, the classic line is 40. You're 33 points back. You've got, what are we, 7 of 9 events done? Is that right?
Yep.
So how would you grade your first 7 events of your sophomore season?
That's a good question. I've never thought about putting a grade on it. I would have to say, like, a B, maybe a B minus, B minus. I feel like if I look at every day that I've competed so far this year on the elites, because when you really break it down to that, like, every day is so crucial. We've fished 7 tournaments. I've made 3 cuts. I've bombed 2 events, and I've barely missed the cut in 2 events. And those 2 bombs, I had decent first days where I was, like, right around the cut line, and then day 2 were terrible. Like, those 2 tournaments and those 2 day 2s were probably my 2 worst days of the season. Every other day that I've competed, I feel like I've kind of been in the game. I kind of know what's going on. Like, the 3 that I made cuts in, I was happy with those tournaments. Pickwick, I just didn't execute on the 3rd or 2nd day, but had the bites to make the cut. And then Gunnersville, I missed the cut by 4 ounces. So I feel like I had a really good shot to make 5 cuts out of 7 so far this year. And I really feel like I've had 2 bad days, which is kind of amazing. Obviously, day 2 at Pickwick and day 2 at Gunnersville weren't ideal, but I feel like I wasn't that far off the mark. I put myself in position to make the cut, and just I didn't get it done. But day 2 in Florida and day 2 on Lake Fork were just brutal. Like, I made the wrong decision on where to go and where I went. I never got settled in, and I just didn't make it happen. But every other event this year, I feel like I'm making better decisions and fishing better than I did last year. I feel more comfortable and, like, feel more positive going into the tournaments. I feel like I've done a better job of practicing this year and trying to cover more water and be confident that I'm not going to spread myself too thin in the tournament. Because that was always my fear in the past, was I was almost too afraid to cover a lot of water in fear that I would spread myself too thin in the tournament, if that kind of makes sense. Because if I look back at all my best finishes that I've had in the Opens and the Elites, it's always when I pick up small, you know, in general, these lakes is, you know, 5 to 10 mile stretch. And if I can break that down, that's usually when I do my best. And so I've tried to get better at covering more water, but still being able to narrow it down during the tournament and be better about kind of getting a feel for a lot more patterns than just a couple, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. That's cool.
And kind of set myself up for day threes too. Like, that's not something I'm used to fishing, day, you know, 3 day tournaments, because it's one thing, like last year on the St. Lawrence was the first cut I made, and then I had nothing to go to on the third day, and I just bombed out and finished, you know, at the bottom of the cut. Whereas this year I've tried to really get better at finding more things for, even if I do make day three, then you can kind of maybe try and make a move to, you know, not finish at the bottom of the, whatever the cut is, 40, 50 guys.
Yeah, totally. And honestly, like, the bar is moving, right? Like, the field is getting better. So, like, even when you're getting better, you need to be getting better at a higher rate than the field, right?
Yeah.
Because most of these guys are also learning. The field's getting stronger. Like, the field didn't get worse when Scott Martin and Jason Christie and Greg Hackney, and, you know what I mean? Like, and right. Ryan New and, like, all these guys joined the tour, right? And it looks like now you're going to have Jason Prosnick, and you're going to have, you know, right? These other guys that are going to, you know, come in. And so, like, the bar's going to keep going up. So you need to, like, keep your game on the, you know, on the incline as well.
Right. Yeah. No, 100%. I mean, the field's going to be, next year, if I'm fortunate to fish next year, it'll be as strong as a field as I've competed against. So yeah, you're dead on.
Interesting question from Bo. Do you think fishing for points is different than fishing for the win for you?
Man, I mean, I haven't really changed my style or approach, I guess, going all the way back to fishing local stuff when you're trying to win, you know, tournaments locally. But you definitely, like, each day is under more of a microscope than it used to be when you're just fishing 1 day tournaments or like a 2 day, you know, a St. Jude deal, you know, back home here. You're definitely making sure that you're taking care of business each and every competition day, and not, you know, making sure that you, I haven't done it, but making sure that you're trying to get a limit every day, no matter what size. The more you talk to guys, I mean, if you catch a limit every day that you compete on the Elite Series, you will probably make the Classic, because it's just, there's usually two or three tournaments that are really tough throughout the year. And if you, you know, catch a limit, like, you look at Fort Loudoun and the Sabine River, for example, you know, I weighed in, I think 14 out of 15 on Fort Loudoun and had a top 15 finish. And there were a lot of guys that didn't weigh in limits that week. So it's not so much a bigger deal like when we go up north, you know, when it's a slugfest and everybody's catching limits. But those grinder ones, if you can catch a limit in those plus the slugfest, then you're probably going to make the Classic.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, do you think when you, like, so last year at Gunnersville, where I think you finished sixth or seventh, and this year at Neely Henry, where you finished sixth or seventh, mm-hmm. did you really feel like you were in either one of those, you really were, like, close to making a charge to the win, or?
So at Gunnersville,
I guess follow-up, did you do anything different on the final day to maybe give yourself a shot, I guess?
Yeah. So at Gunnersville, I honestly didn't really think I had a shot going into the last day. However, I had two bites that day that I didn't land, that if I would have landed, I don't know if I would have won it, but I would have been close. One bite I lost punching a mat, and one I don't even know if you could consider it a bite, but it was a frog fish and like a 6 or 7. My frog was like here, and a 6 or 7 pounder just came up right behind it and missed my frog, and you could just see its whole head come out of the water and just miss it. It wasn't like one of those toilet flushes; it was one of those like slurp. And so I think I had the area to maybe make a run at it. Seth Biter and I were sharing that area the whole tournament. And I think if either one of us would have had it to ourselves, we, you know, either one of us could have made a run at winning that thing. And then at Neely, I actually thought I had a chance to win that one going into the last day. I actually got beat to that stretch on the fourth day that I caught him really good on day three. And if you watch the coverage, the person that started there whacked him pretty good right away in the morning. And even if I would have gained what he had, yeah. So I won't get into it, but basically if I would have weighed in what he had, I still wouldn't have won the tournament, but it would have given me a good start and maybe some momentum to then maybe go flip up a good fish or two. But, you know, the Wes had a great last day. Yeah. I would have really had to catch him. But going into that, not knowing what Wes was going to have, you know, I thought, yeah, I had a legit chance to win it. But I guess to answer your second question, I really didn't – Gunnersville, I didn't do anything different. I just went to the same areas I'd been in. Neely, I kind of – kept with the same adjustments that I made on day three and then ran some of my flipping stuff later in the day too. But I really didn't do anything too different on Neely because I thought I had the areas maybe to try and win that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But cool. It's cool when you're in that position. It doesn't happen very often. So it's kind of fun when it does, obviously.
Yeah, I feel like both of those day fours or day, like in both those tournaments, there, I don't remember if it was on day three or day four, you had like some early bites mm-hmm. in some of those tournaments. So if you're watching Bassmaster Live, you at least had your name up like at the top for a while.
Right. Yeah, and I didn't realize day three, obviously when we're on the water on Neely Henry day three, I didn't know I was leading it for that long. It's just weird. Looking at the live coverage, I just can't believe the timing, like how it just worked out like that, being that other guys were fishing that stretch before me that morning. I don't know if those fish just pulled up or what, but I got pretty lucky to get on that stretch on the third day.
Nice. So you said watching, so you rewatched some of the live coverage? Do you always rewatch it? Do you only rewatch it when you're on it? Like what?
I don't, but I was kind of curious who had all been fishing that stretch throughout the tournament.
Sure.
So that's why I went back and watched it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. What's up, Jay? So we talked about you being 50th and Cash Lopper's right above you. Chris Seldane's right below you. Mm-hmm. You're 33 points back. So I think we kind of talked and like doing the math, you kind of need, I don't know, two top 30-ish finishes, give or take, in the last two tournaments to make the classic. So what's your confidence level going up north? Like, what are you thinking? What are you feeling? Are you excited? What's going through your head?
Yeah, I'm actually more excited than nervous. Like last year going into Fork when I was on the bubble to make the classic, I was actually a lot more nervous just because I didn't know what to expect. But going up to Champlain in the St. Lawrence, we were there last year. We're going to be there a little earlier this year, so that'll be interesting to see kind of how far along. At least on Champlain, those smallmouth, they should be done spawning for the most part, but it'll be real interesting to see what kind of shape they're in, like if they're real skinny rails and they don't weigh anything, or if that'll be interesting how that plays out. But, I'm actually really excited. Last year, I had a terrible first day on Champlain and then had a good, I think I should have weighed 19 pounds, but I had two dead fish day two last year on Champlain. So I feel comfortable there. It's about as close to what we are used to back here in Minnesota, outside of the fact it's just massive. It's so big. And then the St. Lawrence had an okay tournament there last year. Good first 2 days and pretty bad third day. Made the cut. And we're going out of Waddington this year, which is like 60 miles away from where Clayton is, where we went out of last year. So I might be fishing all new water this year. But at least I'll kind of know what to expect. And that place is cool. It's like, if it's clear, obviously. And so I've fished Mille Lacs quite a bit over the years, and it kind of fishes, the shallow fish kind of fish like Mille Lacs do. But the deep water current deal is like nothing I've ever done before. And I've fished the Mississippi a lot, but that's like, you know, 8 foot or less for the most part. Whereas St. Lawrence here, you can see bottom on a clear, calm day in 20 feet of water. Not like clear, but you can tell that's the bottom. Right. So it's a different deal than the Mississippi when you're offshore drifting and stuff. But yeah, I'm excited about it. Honestly, ever since I left both of those places last year, I've probably thought more about those two places than any other place we've been. Just kind of racking my brain on how I can generate more bites or approach it differently. And some of those shallow fish on the St. Lawrence were, they'd get real conditioned to kind of what you were throwing. So I've just kind of thought about maybe different ideas of how to get some of those fish to bite. So yeah, I'm excited to get back up there.
Nice. I would assume Canada's still off limits with them extending it another month at this point.
As of right now, did they extend it another month? I didn't even know that.
I thought I heard that on the radio or something.
Yeah, if that's the case, then it'll probably be off limits. And as of right now, if it stays off limits, they're going to let us go out into the lake. But that's going to be like a 60-mile run rather than a 10-mile run like it was last year.
Or a 70.
Yeah, more like 70 by the time you get out to where you're going in the lake. But the cool thing about this year on the St. Lawrence, it's kind of like what they used to do in Texas Fest, is it's a win and you're in for the classic. So
which one is that way?
The St. Lawrence, the last one. So any guy that's not in the realm of possibility of making the classic can try and win that tournament and get in. So that creates an interesting dynamic with the lake being so far away. You know, you might see some guys way down in the standings make that long run if the weather is decent for that run, being that they could win it and still qualify for the classic.
Interesting. Yeah.
That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. Should make for some good good drama on the final live event.
Right. And I think that's probably what they're going for, but it's good for the anglers too.
Yeah, I think, you know, given the options to spread out and do some things.
Yeah.
Last year on Champlain, did you fish brown, green, mix it up? Like, what was your strategy?
So, so smallies around here, outside of Mille Lacs, I've always feel like I've been burned by smallmouth in tournaments. So if I can fish for largemouth, that's what I like to fish for generally. And so that's kind of what I focus more of my practice on. Outside of like the last day of practice, like last half of the day, I kind of discovered how actual like easy the smallmouth were to catch out there, and how reliable they could be.
Mm-hmm.
But day one, I started on smallies and it just wasn't happening. I don't know if you watched any of the coverage, but a lot of guys kind of struggled on smallies on day one. And then I went and fished largemouth and filled out a small limit, a largemouth. And then caught like one big smallmouth on a stretch that I'd never fished before in practice. And that was like almost a 4-pounder, but I still only had like 14 pounds of mainly largemouth the first day. So day two, I just was told myself I was going to fish completely different. And I started on that stretch with a jerk bait and had like 15 pounds in the first hour. And then I went and flipped docks and caught like a 4-pound largemouth. And then I went to another stretch with a jerk bait and caught a 4-pound smallie. It was just one of those days where everything was kind of just rolling.
Yeah.
So day two is definitely more brown fish and day one was more largemouth. That's why I say I'm kind of curious what stage these smallies are going to be in. Cause last year we were, you know, late July, early August, to the point where those smallmouth, like the ones Polnick were catching, were really healthy and, you know, fat and kind of had their summer, early fall weight. Smallmouth, right, coming off the spawn, you know, you might still get some pretty decent ones, but sometimes they can just be so skinny. So it'd be real interesting to see what kind of shape they're in.
Yeah, you definitely hear the rumblings that they think it's going to lean a little more green than it did last year, but
we'll yeah. See. Yeah, if you look at, like, the FLW events when they're there in June, it seems like the, you know, largemouth or late June, not like around the spawn June, but like when Casey Scanlon won down in Ty, that was like late June and that was all largemouth.
Yeah, I mean, it was really weird how little Ty played when you guys were there.
Really interesting. And I think last year the water was extremely low and like from talking to other guys, it's as low as they had ever seen it up there. And when Casey won, the water was high and there was a lot of current down in Ty. Mm-hmm. Whereas last year, I think there was like hardly any. And I think that's why Ty didn't play as much last year, it seemed like.
Interesting.
So let's see what the water levels are like too.
Cool. So I assume you attended and worked the Classic?
Yeah, so I actually had kind of a unique, it was a fun experience. St. Croix got a boat for me and Jesse Wiggins to ride around in.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a camera guy with us, and we followed Jesse's brother, Jordan Wiggins, and then Pat Schlopper. Yeah. So we got to be on the water, actually, instead of being at the I was at the expo for a little bit Saturday afternoon, but it was a really cool experience. Outside of the fact I wasn't fishing in it, kind of sucked. But if there was any, like, I would have rather been on the boat following them and kind of getting a feel for how the tournament was playing out than, you know, being at the expo. But it was fun. I've talked to a couple people about it, how it's real interesting when you're a spectator and you're not in the tournament, how you just look at things a little differently. Like you just see things that maybe the anglers aren't seeing because they're so dialed into what they found in practice. And kind of gave me a little bit different perspective that I'm maybe hoping to use going forward. Just I try and keep an open mind as best as I can, but it really hit home when I was just watching those guys fish.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Had you been to a Classic before as a spectator?
Nope, never had been. So that part was kind of cool, actually.
So you doing anything cool for the break? You're at home, you're doing some fishing, you're relaxing. What's the game plan before you go north? Like, what are you doing with your time?
I still have a job back home, so I'm working here. And then I've had some guide trips just for some of the sponsors that I work with, just taking out some of their clients.
Mm-hmm.
I have another one on Saturday, actually down on the river. I haven't been there yet this year, so careful. I'm going to head down there and scout it out. We'll see. Hopefully, I'm hoping all the wing dams aren't sticking up out of the water or something. It's so low. It's
supposed to be record low. But
yeah, so I'm trying to just kind of stay sharp. I'm getting married this fall, so there's been some wedding planning going on and all that sort of fun stuff. But trying to, like, stay on bodies of water that will prepare me for Champlain and the St. Lawrence. Like up north, I've been to a few clear smallmouth bodies of water and just pretty much just fishing shallow, like not on bed smallmouth, but like throwing little swim baits or spy baits or you know, just trying to kind of get back in that groove of fishing smallies. And then for largemouth, I've just been flipping a lot of milfoil trying to get ready for Champlain. I don't know what the grass is going to be like when we're out there, being that we're there earlier. But, yeah, it's like any other sport. You just want to be staying on the water as much as you can and stay sharp.
Yeah, I haven't tapped into that. I'm kind of licking my chops to find a good flipping bite. I've kind of like hit just a little piece of it here and there, but I'm waiting to get on like a good flipping bite.
A good one. Yeah. I had a guide trip the other day, and we were mainly catching them like on Drop Shot and Nico and Jigworm with those guys. But then after I dropped them off, I went and flipped some milfoil and caught them pretty decent. I'm messing around with like that fluorocarbon to braid leader deal. I've never really done that in the past, but the more I think about it for that application, it just seems to be the best option. Because I've done the straight braid deal, which I think if the grass is thick enough and the bite's good enough, that you can get away with that. But on pressured bodies of water, it seems like you probably get some more bites on fluorocarbon. So just trying to get a little more confidence in that setup because I haven't done a lot of it in the past.
Yeah. Are you a FGE, Alberto?
Yeah, I'm like literally just in the phases of learning the FGE. And I've done it in the past and didn't put the time in to learn it. And now in the last month, I've put the time in and I can tie it now and have, after catching a bunch of fish doing it, I have confidence doing it. But I can't get that. Like I've always been a back-to-back uni guy. I've just never had that fail. And then I tried I think it's the Alberto. And that one, like it slips out on me like 20% of the time for some reason. So I don't know if I'm tying it wrong, but I just don't have confidence in it. So
yeah, we're going. It's a whole different ball game to tie a casting flipping knot than a spinning rod knot. Like I have no issues on my spinning rods, but I don't have the confidence on the big line and the big hook sets.
Like yeah. I didn't think I would either. But in the last couple of weeks I've done it more and I've yet to have it slip out on me. So I feel
a bit of, yeah, more, yeah. I don't know if it's slipping or breaking or cutting in or
breaking,
whatnot, but like,
yeah.
So that's something I still need to work on is my big line knot game.
Yeah. I kind of put it off forever and I was like, you know what? I need to like buckle down and learn this thing and like don't just make excuses that it's too hard to try, you know, to tie. So I've just in the last, pretty much since I've been home in the last month or so, I've learned it.
Did you make any rod adjustments or using the same rod that you were doing?
So I am using more of a medium heavy with that braid. So like if I used to use like a 7.4 heavy with 20 pound fluorocarbon if I was doing that. And now I went to a 7.4 medium heavy. And that seems to be about right.
Part of my problem is I haven't made any rod adjustments, so I think I might be just like and not changing my rod and not making the adjustment on my hook set yet.
it is a different hook set. Like it's more of like a reel down and not so much a slack line sort of deal. It's just like when I remember switching over to braid on my spinning rods and it became a different hook set, but now it's like second nature.
Right.
So, but it is interesting how many fish are down in that stuff. Cause I always used to be like a weed line or weed edge guy. And I would throw a Texas rig, like I'd throw a jig worm almost, you know, cast it out, kind of work it back. But it's amazing how many fish are actually down in that stuff in like, you know, 4 to 10 foot of water.
It's I'd be the same way. Like I could never like build confidence. I would try it for a little bit and I wouldn't find them. I'd catch one here, catch one there. Mm-hmm. But once you do it and you run into the school when they're tightly packed in that stuff and you get the taste of it 3, 4, 5 times, then like you have the confidence to just hunt them out and just sniff them out. And it's a game changer. Like,
And it was that's like how the largemouth set up on Champlain last year, more so than on the edge, and it kind of exposed me to the fact that like that was somewhat of a hole in my game. Like I could do it, but I wasn't like I don't know. I just didn't feel like I had the right setup or, like you said, the confidence to be able to sniff them out. And so I've tried to really get better at that, you know, later last summer and now this year back home.
Yeah, I'm excited. Got a little junior high school tournament on Saturday. Might be able to get on a little flipping bite. We'll see.
Yeah.
If we can find some milfoil on that lake.
Sure. What was that last question? I didn't see it. Or maybe it was a question.
Might have just been a comment. What's up, Dustin? Out on the bay? That should be fun. Hope you get out. That's a good question. What do you think the best conditions are for flipping milfoil?
I think calm, sunny conditions. Like when you can see those holes and you can see the high spots in the milfoil, that's kind of what you're looking for. If you know there's gravel or rock down below it, obviously that's, you know, that's better. But for the time that I've spent doing it and trying to learn how to get better at it, it seems like when you can find those holes or like the real thick patches that stand up just a little bit higher than everything else, a lot of times that seems to be where they're at. And when the wind's blowing or it's overcast, you just can't see that as well. And I don't think the fish set up in there as well. So I think like fishing on the weed edge is almost better when there's a little wind blowing in to those areas. But when you got calm, sunny conditions, I think those fish kind of suck up into the grass a little bit more. And that's when that bite becomes better.
Yeah. Or even just a tiny, like a little breeze.
Sure.
Where it doesn't affect your sight.
Yeah.
You want to flip, but gives you just a little bit of stealth and gives you a little bit of camo, I think is probably ideal. Like, 4 to 8 mile an hour. I don't know, like 4 to 6, like nice light breeze. Sun definitely helps. Not to say you can't catch them on cloudy days or windy days.
Right.
And if you know the spots already and you have those flipping holes pegged, that makes it a little easier to run your dots and flip in there.
I'd agree.
But the other thing I've learned is it doesn't have to be milfoil.
No.
It literally can just be the best grass in the lake or the area. Like, I'm starting to catch fish in some really what I would call trashy-looking grass, but it's the best trashy grass around, if that makes sense.
100%. I've noticed that already this year. I mean, I caught them really good out of pondweed doing it this year. In, like, 8 feet of water, it was the tallest pondweed in the area, and they were just loaded in it. And then up north, I caught them in cabbage, like, which I know is kind of a thing on some lakes, but on this particular lake, I didn't know they would get it in it like that, but they were.
Yeah, that went to one lake, and I was looking for milfoil and didn't have it, and I just started flipping what was in front of me and found a school of 16 to 19 inches, and I was like,
It's good fun. Luck,
Brennan. What's your go-to bait to flip in the milfoil?
Well, I mean, up here, I flip a craw tube quite a bit. I started flipping that spicy beaver. Well, that was on Neely, but that wasn't really milfoil. Gunnersville, I was doing that a little bit, actually, with a spicy beaver.
That thing will really slow down a weight.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, with that flipping bite, may not always be the best. You might have to up your weight size because that can be definitely more of a reaction bite. But, man, it's hard to beat a craw tube up here anyways. And it seems like they bite it wherever there's grass. They bite it out in New York. And I think, you know, Gunnersville, they eat it down there. But, you know, any bait with a little more bulk to it.
I've been on a big D-bomb kick lately. I caught I played around with that Maxent creature hog last weekend, and I caught a monster.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
It doesn't look like much, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could be something to play around with if you were fishing in pressured areas and, like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, but, for sure. Yeah, if you're letting it
slip. But otherwise, if the bite's good, I got to – actually, they're be coming out soon, but for a while I've been flipping this tungsten Bastech 3/4 ounce, 1 ounce grass jig.
Really? I'll be
coming out and, like, putting a baby D-bomb on that. It's got a little screw lock on it. And when it's good and they're biting, you can't beat that jig because, like, you throw in there, catch them, yank on them, take them off. That bait screw locked on, you're not fixing craw tubes or D-bombs. You're just like boom, boom, boom. Like you're so much more efficient. So
totally. Yeah. Cause that craw tube, you can get to fighting it constantly, like falling down your hook and redoing it. Yeah. So that head have more of like a grass head on it, I guess. Versus
it looks a little bit like a 3/4 ounce tungsten head. Like, yeah.
I see. Cool.
Yeah. If it wasn't buried, I'd get it out.
Yeah.
Any tips for a Wisconsin kid going to Hartwell, the national high school tournament? Have you ever been to Hartwell? Well, you fished No, that was the year before they went there.
Have you fished it?
I did fish like one afternoon at Hartwell a long time ago in the fall before I had a weekend series national championship on Clark's Hill. So, I would think if I'm a northern angler going to Hartwell this time of year, I'd put my money on largemouth chasing brim beds.
Yeah, seriously. That's probably going on down there. So, like topwater and
little prop baits, swim jig.
Yeah.
Maybe a frog.
Maybe a wacky rig.
Yeah. Nikos.
Yeah.
Find those areas that got, spend your practice driving around looking for brim beds, looking for wolf packs, and run those during the tournaments. You know, make those long casts to those areas. And maybe in the morning, see if you can find a schooling hump shoal point thing that you can start on. Yeah. And then during the day, run those brim beds. That's
probably a really good plan. Yeah.
Ooh, Marion. Do you like Marion, Bob?
I've had my days where I like Marion, but I haven't been there in probably 8 to 10 years.
You ain't missing much.
I used to fish all those Lakeville lakes quite a bit growing up.
Right, the first time we ever met was on Marion, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I've had good days out there. I know you've had good days out there too, and good tournaments out there. But I don't know how it is now, but it had decent fish in it for a while. But
it's still got big ones. Like there was a Tuesday night of there 2 weeks ago and 5 fish for 19 pounds.
Yeah. So they're in there. Sometimes they can just be a little stubborn, it seems.
But then like second was 16 and like third place was like 11.
Yeah.
It's just like it's turned into such a drop shot jigworm lake. It's just like,
Yeah, that's kind of what I remember it being too, outside of the spring.
What's up, Carl?
Hey, Carl. Carl's a good old club buddy of mine.
Yeah.
Man.
I like the black and I like the brown and white in certain situations, but I'm usually going to throw a black or a brown.
Yeah.
Most of the time. And then if they're not eating it, I'll try a white. Or if I know there's a lot of shad in the area or something, I'll throw a white. But
yeah, I like black, brown, and then that frog color that has more of a white or yellow belly on it.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, if it's, I don't even know if it matters, but if it's cloudy, I'm pretty much always throwing black. And if it's sunny, I'm pretty much always throwing that yellow or white belly with, or the brown. And honestly, it's probably a confidence thing. I don't know if it really matters a lot. Outside of like the shad deal that you're talking about, I think then it might matter some.
Yeah, like every once in a while, like on the river, you'll see them like chasing shad through the pads or something. And I'll be like, all right, I'm going to throw white then. But man, they were, it was such a good frog bite this last weekend. Like,
yeah,
I think in 3 days, one fish missed my frog.
Oh, man.
Like they were just like,
engulfing,
just everyone was like gagging on it, like
that's awesome,
that's amazing.
I actually, wasn't
like you know how like Leech, they like a killer whale trying to eat a seal, they like blow up out of the water. Like these ones would just come up and just
slurp. Just,
they would, I mean, it would, like they'd hit it, but they were just like precise and like, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
I almost think size of frog matters more than color in a lot of instances. Like I tend to throw a smaller frog in open water and like the regular bronze eye size, in like, you know, sparse cover. And then when you're throwing across a big mat, I actually like the bigger Terminator frog. Yeah. It just moves more water. So I think frog size might matter a little more than color at times.
I think a lot of people sleep on that Terminator frog. It's a pretty good frog.
It is, yeah. And the little one's good in open water.
I mainly flip fluoro in like the non-matagrass, and then the matagrass I throw straight braid.
Yeah,
and I know I need to work on that braid to fluoro thing, like we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I'm the same way as Rich. Outside of I am just kind of started to do the braid to fluoro deal. Only when I'm like flipping into submerged grass that's not topped out. If I'm fishing the weed edge, I still kind of like straight fluorocarbon.
Nice. What's up, BP? Glad you can make it. Nice. What else is there? So, have you seen the new? Have you got your hands on? Have you been able to see the new HB Live, Hummingbird Live?
Yeah, so I actually have it on my boat. I got it put on, what is it, Wednesday? I got it on Monday this week. And I actually went out yesterday evening and messed around with it for a little bit. I still have a lot to learn with it. I've never had a Garmin,
mm-hmm.
Or the Lowrance version, so that was the first. And I've never been in somebody else's boat that's had it either. So it's all new to me, so I still have a lot to learn. And I don't – so to ask, like, how does it compare, I have no clue. Like, I don't know if it's better or worse or equivalent. I'm not – I really don't know.
But maybe I'll have you back on in, like, October, and then
you yeah.
can full report on the HB Live.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I could see my bait on it, but I have some – I must have to get it dialed in more because I couldn't see my bait, like, further out than, like, 40 feet or something like that. So there's got to be – or is that a long – see, I don't even know. Is that a long ways to be seen?
I feel like that is. If I were you, I would Jacob Wheeler maybe, like, 3 months ago did a video where he was comparing the Garmin to the Lowrance. And like yeah. doing a long cast, had them both set up, you know, this is this plug on this yeah. pound line, exact setup. And I feel like he was in that like 40-ish range is where he could see his bait. So
yeah,
if I watched that video, I would think that might give you a lot of insight to what to like maybe expect. Yeah.
And I've watched some of the Bass Tank stuff that's out there, yeah. those guys down in Oklahoma, and they were saying like 35 to 40 is usually where they set it. Mm-hmm. So maybe I was just casting beyond what those things can actually see. I don't know. But I could see it when it was like 25 or in. But it's cool. I mean, you can – it's going to – there's such a fine line with it, like between spending too much time trying to catch fish you can see that aren't going to bite versus just, you know, moving along. So,
yeah, that would be really weary about mm-hmm. fishing it. Like without, if yeah. you, depending on how much time you get to use it between now and when you get out there.
Yeah. That's what
it could be amazing and it could really be a distraction.
I had the same thoughts after spending 3 hours with it yesterday, like to a T. It's like, I got to be careful how, you know, sucked in I get with this thing. Cause you look at like Seth hasn't had it all year and he's clearly done well enough to compete at, you know, and lead angler of the year without it. Whereas everybody going into this season thought that you needed that to be able to compete for an angler of the year. And he's proven that you don't, up to this point anyways. So we'll see if it's different up in smallmouth country, but
you are running Mega 360 though, I assume.
Yeah. And like, I use that all the time. Like that, I almost can't live without that now. I mean, that's pretty amazing. Like on Gunnersville, I was fishing brim beds in, you know, 8 foot of water that no one could see visually, but I was seeing them on my 360, and that's how I was catching them. I mean, so for stuff like that, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Logan says it has to be dead calm, and you have to be right on to see it. Like,
huh, it's interesting. Because that's really like 40 feet is not that far out in front of the boat if you think about it.
Sure.
Like only
two, it's like two lengths of your boat.
Yeah.
To me, I mean, I have a Mega 360 on order that I'm still waiting.
Yeah.
And I've never actually been in a boat like Dan had it on his boat, but he didn't like have it set up or turned on or whatever, so I didn't even use it. And then
yeah,
I've been out a few times in live scope, like in Smith Mountain this spring with a guy, and it was pretty cool, but we also got distracted a lot, and we definitely caught a few bass and we caught several stripers off of it.
Yeah.
But I feel like Champlain's more of a 360 lake and St. Lawrence is more of a live lake, but that's just
my. Yeah. Especially if you're out like on Lake Ontario for sure. But yeah, 360 has its times. Like if you're fishing shallow grass, you know, you're not really using it unless you're looking for bare spots in the grass. It can definitely help for that. Mm-hmm. But like on St. Clair last year, I used it a lot. I did use it a lot on Champlain. So it's like anything. It's so situational. But it was cool to see Caleb win that last tournament on Gunnersville with like no technology. I mean, basically just flipping. So that was like almost a breath of fresh air to see someone just wax everybody, and he didn't need hardly any sort of electronics. So you can still win without them.
Yeah. I gotta say, like I almost made it to the Classic with a 959 on the front of my boat last year.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you still got to learn how to use it in the situations where it's beneficial. It's not just going to make fish jump in your boat. That's for sure.
For sure. You got any tips for 360 settings for bow?
I mean, so mess with your color palettes, whatever. There's everybody's eyes are a little bit different, I think. So, you know, what color palette might be good for me isn't always the best for the next guy. I think I use the number 2 or 3. It's like one of the amber colors the most. And then just mess with your sensitivity and your contrast, like wherever you go, because every lake is a little bit different for whatever reason. I don't know if there's just like different water clarities make the contrast and sensitivity different, just like with side imaging. So you kind of got to mess with that each day that you're out there. And then take into consideration the depth that you're in to determine kind of how far your target actually is away from you. And what I mean by that is like if you got your ring set out to 80 feet and you're in, and then you got rings, there's like 20, 40, 60, 80.
Bob, I'm going to be right back.
Okay.
You got 3 minutes. Yep. Keep it going.
Yep. I'm good. And so if you're in 20 foot of water, you've got to minus that from the 80-foot ring. So the first 20-foot ring is just going to be water column, if that makes sense, on an 80-foot ring. So if you got like a rock pile that's on your 40-foot ring, that's actually only 20 feet from the boat because you are 20, you're in 20 foot of water. So kind of keep that in mind. I don't know if that made sense at all, but to kind of get a better idea what I'm talking about, once you get it, like go up, you know, go to a clear lake where you can maybe see bottom in 8 foot of water and find something out in front of you. And you'll kind of see what I mean in terms of how far that actually is. What I've learned is like 20 to 40 feet is actually not as long of a cast as you might think. You know, it might show up at 30 feet on your ring and it's just not much of a flip to get out to that distance. So that's really a few things, I guess, that I've learned. Typically, I just keep it on the front half of the overall circle. So it's mainly like shooting out to the side and then anything in front of my boat. So very rarely will I look at the full circle. I don't really care what's behind me unless I'm maybe, you know, spot locked offshore and I kind of want to see everything around me. So the reason for kind of using that, you know, front half moon is, and zooming in on that only, is you're just going to get a lot more detail, depending on what size screen you're on. So yeah, I use it a lot. Like there was one day this year, I, for whatever reason, I wasn't thinking clearly and I like didn't flip the switch in my boat to make the 360 work. And I thought my 360 was like broken and I was freaking out. Like I need this to be able to tell what I'm doing. So that kind of really hit home on how much I actually use it.
Nice. Yeah. I think, I don't know, I could be wrong, but I think up here in Minnesota, I think 360 is more useful day in, day out.
Way more, especially when you're fishing grass edges and stuff. You can't really see the fish unless they're maybe off the edge with live scope. But with 360, you can see the bare spot in the grass or the hard spot that's right up next to the edge with 360. And you just can't really, you're not going to see that with live scope.
There you go. Bill's giving you a kudos.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, it took me a while to figure that out. Like, I discovered that on Eufaula last year when we were fishing brush piles. Like, I was in 15 foot of water and thrown at a brush pile that, you know, on my map said it was at, like, the 50-foot ring, and I kept going way past it. And it was because it was actually not 50 feet away. It was really 35 feet away. So that's just one. You don't really notice it when you're in shallow water, but when you're like 10, 15 plus feet deep, you definitely kind of notice that.
Nice. Jay, best time to fish pencil reeds? Early morning, cloudy, or with a breeze? Like, I feel like, I mean, there's exceptions. Well, they'll be in there in high sun and things, but I feel like low light or wind seems to be best.
I'd agree with that. They tend to get them into them in the fall a little bit too.
Sure.
Like before it gets real cold, if you're on a lake with a bunch of them, that seems to be a good time of year.
And it's almost impossible to have too much wind.
Yeah.
Like other cover seems to, like pads, like a little bit of wind seems to really make them hard to fish, but mm-hmm. It really has to be rolling. Like a pretty good breeze into the reeds can really get them fired up, especially like a lake like Pokegama. Like,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. And I don't know if this pertains all, there's like true all the time, but it seems like if you can find a reed bed in a contour, like a deeper contour line that butts mm-hmm. up against one side of that reed bed or one particular stretch of that reed bed, like they can be in it all day long. Or, you know, that just seems to be the better stretch a lot of times is when there's deep water nearby. Maybe not.
It also depends how deep. If they're deeper reeds, then right. You don't need as much. Like, so
right.
The low light and the wind definitely helps if those reeds are like 2.5 feet or less. But if them reeds are 3, 4, 5 feet, you can, yeah, almost could be better in the high sun.
Yeah.
All right. We got a St. Croix question.
Yeah, so I use two specific rods for spinner baits. If I'm fishing around shallow targets like wood or grass where I'm just making real short underhand casts, I've had this 6'6" medium fast spinnerbait rod forever, and that's the pistol one. Grip. What's that?
Pistol grip. That's
okay. Yeah, it's almost should be a pistol grip. It's that's pretty much what I throw. So I find myself using that a lot of times in the spring when, you know, fish are just moving up to some of that, you know, rock, wood, cover up on the bank. And then if I'm actually making a longer cast with maybe a heavier spinnerbait, there's actually a 7-foot I think it's a medium heavy moderate that I like to use. But you could use a, you know, a 7 to a 7.4, you know, somewhat more of a medium heavy moderate or medium action rod for spinnerbaits. The 6.6 is an Avid, and that 7 foot medium heavy moderate is in their Legend Tournament Bass series, one of the blue rods.
Interesting question. Hard to say. I got two ideas here. I think you either go small, like 2.8, like Kytex Swimmer, or you show them something big, like a swim bait or a glide bait. Go to the extremes. Cool. Like fish, like every fish in every pond around here sees like 4,000 spinner baits and 4,000 Senkos. They get really conditioned to like the same thing. So either go really small or go big.
Yeah, and like if you get a windy day, like a big glide bait could be fun out there. Could be the deal. Yeah.
Or like, this is a great, this Dream Smasher is a pond smasher.
Yeah, that looks good.
Cody, go search like pond bass on my channel and you'll see. How do you fish a brush pile without getting stuck?
Well, so I didn't grow up fishing brush piles. I don't have a ton of experience doing it, but what I was doing last year on Eufaula is just throwing a big Texas rig worm. So you just rig it. You rig it weedless style like you would up here in, you know, the Midwest when you're fishing grass. And you're better off to kind of creep it through there rather than like force your bait through there. If you get hung and you really start like, you know, really start like pulling on it, you're more apt to like dig that bait into the brush or the wood rather than if you just kind of slowly lift and pull it through. That tends to be better. So that's, you know, with Texas rigs, I think Buddy Gross, one down there throwing a jig with just a brush guard on it. You know, you can reel, if you know exactly where it is and how tall it is, you can reel stuff over the top of it or around it too. You know, you're maybe more apt to get stuck in it doing that, but that can be effective if you kind of know how high it is off the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, if you have the privilege of live front-facing sonar and you can see your bait and you can see the brush pile, you know, then you can, you know, slow roll a spinner bait. You can bring a Kytec. You can do a lot of things just over it where you're just ticking it and not getting really hung up, right? But like shaky heads, super, super popular with brush piles. Mm-hmm. And then drop shots, use like a VMC, what do they call the one with the little
finesse
Nico with the little wire guard and Texas rig it like a trick worm or something like that. But I think it is a lot has to do with feel, right? Like don't get too excited, shake it, pull it, feather it through. I mean, you're going to get hung up, right? That's going to happen. You just got to try to reduce it a little bit.
Yeah. And sometimes you'll think, especially if you're using tungsten, you'll bump a limb and think it's a fish and you set right into the brush pile. So it happens.
Like you come over a limb, fall in the next one, you're like, doop.
Yeah.
What's up, JP? Better late than never. All right. I guess that's some really good questions. If you guys got other questions, keep them coming in. I don't know, is there anything else new for you this year? Anything else, new techniques, new things you're dabbling with?
I've tried to get a little more confidence in throwing the Nico rig this year. I dabbled with it a little bit last year. I threw it a lot just in the last couple of weeks. And, man, you wouldn't think it'd be much more effective than, like, a jig worm or a drop shot, but man, sometimes it really kind of is. So I've been doing that some. I'm like kind of on purpose to be able to try and throw it more out on Champlain and maybe even the St. Lawrence. Trying to continue to get better with that spy bait. I've been throwing that some and like experimenting with colors. And I've been messing around with some jig heads that have the little propellers on them. You guys probably know what I'm talking about if you fish smallmouth. and just different baits behind that, like not necessarily swim baits, just to kind of maybe show them a little bit different look. So like more your just your straight tail, like minnow looking stuff. So
just some of those, like a West Coast dart head type thing.
Yeah. So just trying different things to maybe give these smallmouth a different look out on the St. Lawrence a little bit. And then, like I was saying earlier, just that braid to fluorocarbon deal that I haven't messed around with much. But, yeah, just trying – I try and make an effort to just, like, continually get better every time I go out and, like, just really kind of hone your craft in a way. And before I qualified for the elites, I would – you're obviously – you know, wanting to get better and learn every time, but I feel like I'm putting more of an emphasis on that now than I ever have in the past. That's what keeps it interesting too. I mean, learning new techniques and kind of sticking with what you're confident in, but at the same time, like trying to get better with whatever else might be coming out. And it's weird. Like a lot of stuff you try is like, doesn't work. But you never know when you might come across the next Ned rig of sorts, you know, and it might look stupid, but sometimes it works. And so just trying to kind of keep experimenting with all different stuff.
Yeah, I feel like I need to go back to the Nico rig because I had a couple of days on Gunnersville like 2 Aprils ago and like it was like them fish had never seen it before and the lake is pressured and like
weird.
Throwing like my co-angler was throwing a wacky rig and he couldn't bye-bye it and I was just clubbing him like in big ones. Like it was like
I don't know what it is about that thing. It's not much different than a Texas rig or something like that, but yeah. When do I pick up a spy bait or a swim bait? I've only really thrown a spy bait for like the last year or so I'm not really an expert on it, but honestly, I'll try both of them in like the same areas, spy bait and a swim bait. I feel like when the water is super clear and the fish are maybe a little conditioned, like they've had some pressure, that spy bait for whatever weird reason can kind of draw them in and make them bite. I've caught them in really like slick, calm conditions, and I've caught them in windy conditions with it. With a swim bait, I tend to like a little more wind. So if it's slick, calm, I might pick up that spy bait first and just see if I can't get one to bite. I'd honestly rather catch them on a swim bait because it's just a single hook. Spy bait, man, it's your landing percentage is tough on that deal. And I think it's because the trebles are so small. And you're dealing with smallmouth, and that's just like a bad recipe sometimes.
It's interesting. Some people, like I had Josh Bertrand on a couple months ago, and he was like, man, I like never lose fish on a spy bait.
Really?
Like, there's some people that are like say it's iffy, and other guys are like, it's so on. So I don't know.
That's yeah. Like I had a decent landing percentage on the St. Lawrence last year, but I definitely lost 2 key fish on it that, you know, would have helped. So, but I also got lucky and landed a couple big ones on it.
So what type of spinning rod are you using on these experimental bladed?
So I think I'm still kind of messing around. The rod I was using the other day was a medium light extra fast. And it just happened to be one that I had. It was like a 7.3. And it felt like that rod was a little bit light for that head. Like I landed a lot of fish on it, but I lost some too. So I think like a 7.2 to 7.4, more of a medium action spinning rod might be a little bit better to just drive that hook in, like on your initial pull into those fish.
I mean, is it any different than a rod you throw a small Kitek or a Largo Shad on?
No, yeah. Not really. Like I was throwing a lighter one, so I kind of had to use a spinning rod to be able to cast it. But I typically like a medium heavy for a Kitek, like a 3.3. Mm-hmm. Like maybe every rod company is different, but like more of like a softer medium heavy, I guess. Especially with smallmouth, I don't like totally jack them, but I definitely lean into them and like to kind of drive that hook home when they bite.
I don't know. I definitely don't have a favorite swim bait for spots because I don't fish spots enough.
On Smith Lake in the open a couple years ago, I caught quite a few on like a 3.3 Kitec. Was in practice, that bite was really good, and it kind of faded on me in the tournament. I ended up catching them on a Ned rig and then a swim jig around docks. But yeah, that 3.3 Kitec or the 2.8, I think when I was with Jesse Wiggins, I was saying the other week at the Classic, I think he likes that 2.8 on Smith quite a bit. So that's probably what I go with.
Nice. Yeah, if you guys haven't, hit that thumbs up in case you forgot. That'd be awesome. Ooh. So I think we covered most of the things. I don't know if there's – we'll kind of open it up. If there's any last questions. I don't know. Are you fishing anything? Are you sneaking in any? Like, is it all just fun fishing when you're back home? Or are you going to do anything back home tournament wise? Like, any?
Probably not this month. Maybe once our season wraps up. If I get some time, you know, later this summer and into the fall, I'll maybe jump into some. But I don't, right now, I have nothing on my schedule.
Nice. Basscat's running good.
It is. Yeah. I actually already sold it. So I'm hoping. Nice. Hoping I'll have a boat into the at least September a little bit, but we'll see how soon he wants it. But yeah, it's been good. I really like that era. It's the same one I ran last year, and it fishes a lot like my Pantera 2 did actually. It's just a little bit longer, but it's kind of agile and like the P2 is. Mm-hmm. So I like it.
Well, if you're boatless, you can give me a call. We can
take
the Classic out.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, I'll have to give you a shout.
Maybe do a little filming. In the comments, who would want to see Bob out with Hellebass doing a little fishing video and ripping on some bass?
Yeah, especially like September, October, that'd be fun.
Bob ain't afraid to put a jig on and go flip some docks and trees. He ain't afraid.
No. Oh, that's like my favorite thing.
Yeah. Nice. Well, cool, dude. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this has been awesome. If you guys came in late, make sure you watch the replay. If you prefer to listen, you can catch it on the podcast version. Just search Hellebass in your favorite podcast. Ask John Wood said he'd watch it. Yeah, awesome. Make sure you support Omnia, support Arsenal Fishing. The codes are down below. Check out, a lot of great stuff from Rapala and companies that Bob works with at Omnia Fishing that you can tap into.
Yeah.
I don't know. Any other shout outs, Bob?
I don't think so. No, thanks for having me on. Like Rich said, go check out Omnia, all the good stuff they got. I saw you said they had some flatworms in now, so they're probably sold out.
Should we do a live check-in on the flatworms since they're sold out? I did share it on my story, so let's see.
I'm kind of sold out.
You guys missed it.
They're sold out.
Sold out.
Well, they're not there anymore, but I'm sure they'll be back soon.
So if you want, you follow Hellebass on Instagram because I watch for these kind of things on Omnia. And when there's good stuff, like when they get the right nag drafts in, or they get flatworms, or they get cool stuff in, usually share it out of my story and let you guys know. But rule number one is Hellebass always gets his before he shares the story out. Yeah. So I ordered a couple packs for myself before I shared.
There you go. That was smart. Yeah. Yeah, go check them out, guys. Those guys are awesome over at Omnia. They do a good job, and they got some good stuff there.
Yeah, very good. Well, as always, guys, remember to like, subscribe to the channel. We're here to help you catch more big bass and suck less.
Thanks, guys.
always, thanks to all of you that hung in till the end of this podcast. This has been another episode of the Hellebass Bass Fishing Podcast Experience. Please consider sharing this with any of your bass and buddies and friends. This is the best way for podcasts to grow is through word of mouth. Also, don't forget to search Hellebass on Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, or just about anywhere else so that we can connect in more ways. As always, here to help you catch more bass and suck less.